Get that? Whoa, like there's a lot going on here. But let's do this. I wrote out a summary. I just tried to boil it down into one paragraph. We'll pass those around now. And see if this makes some sense out of it. I mean, the problem is there are just so many different things going on. But this is what makes sense to me. This is the condensed version. We all have the almost have them. And again, at the top of the handout, just the same outline as before, just to help you see, remember where we are in light of the whole. We're getting close, by the way, to the end of a major section. Chapter 35, the end of 35, then chapter 36, it's a very different, then it's a story. Actually, four chapters of just story that may well be familiar to you already. But okay, I don't normally read but to you, well, besides the Bible, but I'm going to read this, because I think it may be helpful. And I'm summarizing the chapter from start to finish here. I just kind of went through the 24 verses. He writes, "The wicked are oppressing us, but they will be destroyed. God, come and save us, for you are able and you have promised." That gets us through the first six verses. "Lord, the land is devastated because of our covenantal unfaithfulness, but you will come and destroy the sinners. You will protect the righteous one and bring him into your kingdom. The kingdom will be characterized by a beautiful king, an expansive land, freedom from oppressors, a secure Jerusalem where God will live and rule. The kingdom will be filled with plunder taken from the defeated enemies. In Jerusalem, all sickness will be healed and all sins will be forgiven." So that's how I boil it down. I don't know if that helps. But the reality is that Isaiah and his people are in dark days. There's bad things happening, and people disagree on exactly what the bad things are that Isaiah is talking about. Are the betrayers? Some people think it's the Assyrians. That the Hezekiah had made a tribute payment to the Assyrians, thinking like this will solve the problem, the Assyrians will go away and they won't attack us anymore. And now the Assyrians had betrayed them by still attacking. That's a major view that I don't accept. But it could be, and it doesn't change the heart of the passage. Another is that they're just they're living with a lot of wicked people, and they're being oppressed and being betrayed. And you know, I read the first verse here. It's kind of like, you know, the mafia. You know, you have this crime world, right? And they, you know, I've never had any personal experience with the crime world, but I guess you've seen a movie or, you know, something, and you just feel like I'd never want to live in that world, because you always have to be watching your back, and as soon as you're not taking someone out, they're going to be taking you out, right? I mean, it's just deception and lies, and you never know who you can trust. You can't trust any of them. That's the picture I get in the first verse. That's the context of evil. But it's Isaiah is saying, look, in the middle of that, this is what God's going to do. This is our hope. And I think verse 2 is a prayer. God, help us. We believe you can help us, so please help us. Be our strength every morning. This is a good prayer for us. And then verses 3 through 6, I think I take it more as a statement of faith. God, we believe that you can do this. We believe that you will rescue us. We know, verse 5, we know that you're exalted. Remember, Isaiah had seen the Lord exalted. We know that you're able to solve our problems. Right now, we don't see it, but we believe it. You know, this is this morning we sang a song. How did the song go in church? Glorious. It had the word glorious.
You make all things glorious.
You make all things glorious. Yeah. So this song bugged me a little bit because if I was thinking of it in the sense of my difficult life right now, it's not true that God makes things glorious now in every way. I mean, there's some things. I mean, he's, you know, you were praying for Mark. It was tough a week and a half ago. Now Mark's out of the hospital and he's recovering. He's doing well, and we're thankful for that. And so we can say, well, but some of us, you know, we're not. We're still in the hospital, right? I mean, some of with relationships or finances or whatever. And it's not, we can't say you make all things glorious right now. So I'd rather that song, and it probably doesn't work with the meter, you know, the beat. But you will. I mean, that's more true, in my opinion. I mean, that's more, and that's what Isaiah is saying. It's not, like, right now, it is a mess. Life hurts. But you will. It's true. Right now, you are high and exalted. And I'm going to put those two together. My life is a mess now, with your high and exalted. And I know what's going that's going to come together, and you will make all things glorious. That's what Isaiah is saying here. And verse 6 too. Don't miss verse 6. Go back to verse 3. You know, whatever your problem is, Isaiah says, at the thunder of your voice, the peoples flee. I mean, that's all of God's enemies. They can't stand up to him. Whatever your enemy is, or, you know, your, it's nothing compared to God. They just, as soon as God rises up and say, well, God, rise up right now because I can't handle it. I can't, well, that's, Isaiah demonstrates here the faith that waits. Faith that says, Lord, we long for you, be gracious to us, we're waiting. And we wait with the knowledge that you will save. You will, we don't know when. Isaiah, that's a big thing. I've said it a few times, but I'll say it again. Right? The main thing that Isaiah does not know is when. He knows that. He knows that God is going to deliver Judah from all the sinful, wicked, corrupt officials, neighbors, all of that. He knows he's going to deliver him from all of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, but he doesn't know when. And that's, we know that Jesus is coming back. We don't know when. We know that we will be glorified in our, and we will be done with our sinful flesh. Well, we don't know when. We wait in faith.
It's hard to interrupt.
No, you're supposed to. You're not interrupting. We're having a conversation. I'm just doing most of the talking.
I had a thought about God making all things glorious and it not seeming like it or whatever. But, you know, I'm a firm believer, you know, studying the New Testament, that, you know, God gives us the faith. So, in that respect, God is making it glorious and he's given us the ability to trust through hard times and difficult times. Mm-hmm. So, to me, that there's some glory in the faith.
I agree. I don't know that the New Testament, I mean, I think that's still true in Isaiah's day, before the New Testament. We just have more reason to have that hope. And just one example being the resurrection. I mean, Isaiah's knowledge and understanding of a resurrected body and of heaven and all of that seems to be a bit murky. He didn't know that much. He knew that, but yeah, so the New Testament's definitely filled out our hope in that way that we're others. Others? You're not interrupting. You're supposed to. I mean, I have a lot I want to say, but no matter what, I won't say it all. So just a matter of you're welcome to jump in and say, I think it means this, or what about that? But I did put an outline on page 2 here. And major ideas. This is just, I kind of, because the chapter swings back and forth a bit between judgment and hope, and I just thought it would be kind of convenient to summarize the main points for you there. And I put it in 8 points, but let's look at we'll look at verses 7 through 9. This section here is probably the most somber verses of the chapter. And at the beginning here, he's saying, for instance, the envoys of peace weep bitterly. Do you remember just a couple chapters back where you had the envoys going down to Egypt? They loaded their camels with the tribute. They were going down to Egypt to make a deal, make a treaty. Egypt, you need to help us because we're rebelling against Assyria, and so we'll pay you all this money, and you bring your army up here and you fight with us. And Isaiah was saying, no, don't do it. Don't go back to Egypt. God said specifically, do not go back to Egypt. But more, not only that, I mean, well, you don't need to trust Egypt to save you. God's good enough. So recall your ambassador. And here's what happens. The envoys weep bitterly. Right? It was in vain. They spent their money, all paid all the tribute. It didn't work. They didn't get peace. They didn't get deliverance. The highways are deserted. What does that mean? Right? The land's been destroyed. There's nobody moving about. There's no trade. There's no commerce. There's no travelers. The land, verse 9, is devastated. Now, let me draw your attention to a few words here. A few places. Lebanon, you know what Lebanon is because of the modern country. It has the same name. But it's very productive. It's very fertile. It's got mountains, trees, lots of rain. And these other places, Sharon here, is a very productive, it's the coastal plain, gets a lot of rain. But when it says Sharon is like the Arava is the deep rift valley near the Dead Sea. Gets almost no rain. So he's saying, what would you say here? It'd be like, Hawaii is like Odessa, or Midland, or
Big Bend.
What's the desert? What's the desert? The dead desert.
Death Valley,
Death
California.
Valley.
So that's the picture here. Bashan and Carmel drop their leaves. Now, this is Mount Carmel. You know about Elijah goes up there. Been up there a lot of times, and when I go up there, we're riding on the bus, and I always read to the students this verse and a few other verses which talk about the productivity of Carmel. And always, no matter what time of the year I'm there, now right now it's May 9th, so usually I'd be starting to teach a 3-week program in Israel. I'm not going this year, I'm staying here. But for many years, and in May, I'd be flying out this afternoon, I guess. If I was going, but the land starts to dry out, the green's turning to brown, and but whenever you go to Mount Carmel, it's always green. There's always trees. It's even in late October, it hasn't been rained for 6, 7, 8 months, still green. But here it says Carmel is dropping its leaves. So I've never seen that. So this is a very dark day, at the end of a long famine, a long drought, rather.
if that ever happened. I mean, was there a time when those periods fruitful now were unfruitful?
Well, I would surmise that when there was the 3 years of drought in the days of Elijah and Ahab, that it probably was pretty bad then. But that was 3 years when it didn't rain a drop at all. I mean, Israel's in a bad drought right now. They've had low rainfall for at least 4 years. Sea of Galilee is low, really low now after the winter, and they've got to do all. And it won't rain a drop of water until probably November, maybe October. And so they're in a really bad spot. But it rained. So the Mount Carmel, even after these years, it's still green. I think that this passage is speaking about something in the future. There might have been something, well, there were in Isaiah's days difficult situations, trials, attacks, maybe some droughts, but I think the language here, I think it's speaking about a future day of judgment. And it's going to be at that time when the judgment is severe that God arises, verse 10. And God's going to come to deliver his people.
Are you saying still in our future?
Yes. In my opinion, yes. The problem with this chapter and other chapters in prophecy are, you can think of it in terms of horizons. There's the horizon of Isaiah's day, like 700 BC. Like this is what's going on now. And then there's the distant horizon of the future. And so interpreters here disagree on, like, well, how much of which horizon am I seeing here? And everybody agrees that there's some of both in this passage. But how much of each is a little bit of debate. And I decided that I wasn't going to spend much time this morning giving you a view that I don't agree with, which is that Isaiah is pretty much just talking about the Assyrian attack. That's the other view, is that he's just talking about, and it's sort of a hyperbolic language for him to say that, you know, that Mount Carmel is dead. I think maybe there was a foreshadowing in Isaiah's day of this great day, but I think ultimately this passage is talking about the day when God comes. And that becomes really clear in the verses that follow, right? And to me it's goofy, to use a technical scholarly word, when scholars want to say this whole thing is pretty much fulfilled. Like verse 17, your eyes will see the king in his beauty. Oh, that's Hezekiah. I don't think so. For one, it's a strange way to describe Hezekiah. And you could use his name. And you don't talk about kings usually being beautiful. And then it says, and view a land that stretches afar. That doesn't describe Hezekiah's kingdom. Do you remember that Israel and Judah were divided into two? You have the 10 tribes in the north. And they were carried off about 20 years earlier. So all that's left is Hezekiah, Judah, one tribe. I mean, they got a little bit of Benjamin, but it's... What did I mentioned this before. I mean, we're talking the DFW Metroplex. Less than that. That's all that it... I mean, less. Less than that. That's all there is. So, to say, you know, that this was fulfilled then, it wasn't. I mean, God did not give to Judah a land that stretches afar. And he didn't give them this king. So I think Isaiah's painting for them the picture of, you know what, hope in God, trust in God, because he's able to do this and he will do this. You know, let's go back. I just jumped over a few verses. Look at verse 14. God is coming, and when at his approach, sinners are terrified. Right? That's, I think, an obvious observation. Right? Sinners are terrified of a holy God. Sinners that they can deny it, you know, to themselves and to their friends or whatever, that they're guilty, but in the face of a holy God, they're exposed. They know that judgment's coming, and they ask. So verse 14, who of us can dwell with the consuming fire? That's a good question. And then they repeat it again, with different words slightly. Who of us can dwell with everlasting burning? That's God, right? I mean, what is it? Is it in Hebrews? Or let me look this up. Where does it say God is a consuming fire? Anybody remember? I don't either. So, but it does. And it says it here too. I mean, God's very presence by His holiness, He's a consuming fire. And what's that? Hebrews 12. And the writer of Hebrews had been reading Isaiah 33 and some other passages as well. But so what's the answer? I mean, who can, and this is for us and for our friends, and I mean, who can live with God? Verse 15 is the answer. It's the right answer. It's the righteous person. And it defines a little bit about what that means to be righteous. It means you're not cheating. You're not taking bribes. You're not joining in on plots of bloodshed. Basically, you're separate from iniquity, from evil. That's who can survive. And that's the one. So here's a picture. Come back here. I don't know how clear I've been this morning, but you have an evil community. I mean, an evil land, evil people. But there are righteous people in it too, a remnant. At a certain time in the future that the righteous people are waiting for, God will arise and come to deliver, to redeem, to create anew. And when He comes, He will terrify the wicked, and he will even consume them. Maybe that goes a little bit further than what it says right here, but the righteous will go through that. Right, the righteous will be saved. The righteous will, and that's what verse 16 says. And then verse 17 and following now is pretty much focused on what that future is going to look like. So if you make it through and your righteousness is demonstrated, here, this is maybe a point to just note briefly. Who is righteous? It's the one who lives righteously. It's not the one who says necessarily something. It's not the one who claims, well, you know, I went to church, or I made a decision. It's the one who lives a certain way. Isaiah doesn't want people saying, well, I'll run up to the temple and I'll make a sacrifice, and I'll, you know, say, God, I'm sorry, and then I'm going to go back to cheating my neighbor and taking bribes on the side. That's not good enough. That won't get you through. Okay, verses 17 and following here to wrap this up.
Before you begin,
yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I love the, who among us can live with continual burning? Mm-hmm. It's asking the question, and it's us. We actually live with a God that's a consuming fire. Mm-hmm.
And then it's like a conundrum or something. It's a paradox because we aren't righteous. So how do it begs the question, how can we, the unrighteous, live with a consuming God? And he's answering that question. It's how we live, but the underlying thing there is verse 17. We've got a king that loves us, and he holds back that consuming fire. But am I reading that right, or am I getting a little too?
No, you're exactly right. There's a tension going on here, and I'm not resolving that tension for you because Isaiah's not resolving that tension. The tension is, yeah, how can we be righteous? And the last phrase of the chapter says, their sins will be forgiven. So that partly solves the tension, but it doesn't explain how their sins will be forgiven. But Isaiah's going to do it later. And an important point here, too, to note, and I'm not not going to make too much out of this, but the king that's here, Isaiah's talked about a king before. In chapters 7, especially 7, 9, and 11, the messianic prophecies, you know, unto us a child is born, a son is given, and his name will be, and he's going to rule on the throne of David. And so we've been introduced to this king, and then in the beginning of chapter 32 last week, see a king will reign in righteousness. Oh yeah, here's that king again. And then here's the king again, but he's not, but as we continue on through Isaiah, we're going to see that king is also a servant. And I'll make that point. It's very, very clear that the servant is a king. And then we're going to see what that servant does. Namely, in dying, he laid our... How does it go? Isaiah 53. You know, I don't remember. The pressure's on, and I can't quote these verses right now. But right, the Lord has laid on us the iniquity
of us all.
The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That's who's the him? It is the servant. And that servant, I'll show you, is the king. And one other thing. Let me remember here. It's verse 5 says, the Lord is exalted, for he dwells on high. Those two words are used only two other times in Isaiah. In Isaiah 6:1, I saw the Lord high and exalted. This is clearly God sitting on his throne. And then here again, the Lord is exalted, for he dwells on high. The only other time those two words are used together is in Isaiah 52:13. See my servant, he will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. This is very interesting. It's saying here that the servant, who is the king, we get that in chapters 42 and 49, is high and exalted, which is only otherwise used of the Lord. So, if you want to say, like, if you're living in the year 100 BC, could they possibly imagine that Jesus would be the king who would die on the cross and also be God himself? Could they have figured that out? Well, I think they could have. I know that many of them didn't. Well, and I think, too, remember Jesus, he's walking on the road on the day of his resurrection, and these two disciples are downcast. Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, he says to them, you know, guys, I understand why you don't get it. He doesn't say that. He rebuked them because they didn't understand. Now, I don't want to be too hard on them. To those, you know, I'm not saying I'm any better. I have a lot of advantage over them because I got like Luke 24 written out for me and all these other passages too. But I'm using that to support my interpretation. I think this is what's going on here, but it's still a little bit mysterious here. He doesn't, in chapter 33 anyway, he doesn't come out and say, the king is going to die and he'll be your forgiveness. But he does, we got the king, and we've got forgiveness, and we've got, you've got to be righteous if you're going to live in the presence of the king. So, these vectors here, these tensions.
God just, you get a piece of his personality. He loves puzzles. And he loves people in our brains. That's the theological statement.
Yeah. God's pretty smart. And, I mean, this book is just so... I mean, just imagine, you know, if this book was something like, well, I read it once, and now I got it, and I'm reading something else. I mean, we just got to work at this. But, I mean, he did, at the same time, it's so brilliant, but yet it's accessible. And, I mean, it's both. And you can get in if you're, you know, our daughter's, you know, how old is Kate? We just got her Bible. She's 6, so she can't read it quite as well. But you know, at a young age, and then you can be... Brilliant scholars spend, you know, 60 years of a career and not figured out. So, well, I missed some things. I'll just say, note here too, that this king is going to rule in Jerusalem. Okay, that's a big idea that I didn't say much about. But that's another thing too, why I think this has got to be talking about the future. It's not, God didn't come and rule in Jerusalem in 685 B.C. Pray. Lord, again, we love to study your word, particularly as it expresses the hope that we have. And this is our hope, and we have some understanding by virtue of your son coming and living among us and teaching us and teaching his disciples who wrote the New Testament. Maybe some understanding into things that the people of Isaiah's day didn't. But still, this is so instructive and helpful for us to see the way in which you have unfolded your plan. And so much of that, Lord, is still in our future. We still live in a day in which people are destroying and betraying, in which sinners are pervasive in our society and even in many churches in this country and world, and so we take encouragement from this in the way that you will one day purify this earth, redeem this earth, redeem your people, and that we'll be part of that. That we will be able to live as hard as it is to fathom with you. On this earth, you are consuming fire, and your king, our Messiah. So we long for that day. We want to long for it more. I mean, that's, you know, that's a major deficiency we have, that we are not longing enough, that we are not desiring as much as we should your appearance and our glorification. So we seek for the work of your Spirit in our lives, and we give you thanks for what he has done already. In Jesus' name. Amen.
Yes. Thank you. I forgot to remind everyone, we'll start on June 6th. Things are switching up, and so we will meet first. They're going to announce it as 9 o'clock, but we're going to start.